Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Institute of Leadership and Management's weekly news roundup podcast, where I, Rod Jones, content manager, and Kate Cooper, head of research policy and standards at the Institute, take a critical look at what's been happening in the world of leadership and management up to the 14th of September 2020. Hello, Kate.
Hello, Rod.
Well, our first story, Kate, asks, how can employers avert a leadership skills gap? Firms in the construction and infrastructure sector must safeguard new talent to avert a leadership skills gap, according to WSP UK boss Mark Naismith, who called on industry leaders to harness the Construction Leadership Council, CLC, talent retention scheme. This scheme enables firms to help colleagues who have lost jobs during the pandemic back into work, makes it easier for employees to find candidates for any emerging vacancies, and Naismith stressed that spreading the word about the CLC portal is vital to retain skills and talent within our sector. He warned, if, in addition to the challenges that are facing us at the moment, current graduates and apprentices were made redundant as the recession starts to bite, we will be creating problems for our sector in years to come. Kate, what actions can employers in other sectors take to prevent the type of leadership skills gap that Naismith highlights?
Well, this is a particularly pertinent question, isn't it? Because this week we're releasing some research that we did in conjunction with the Chartered Institute of Housing in the UK, which identified this very thing, a looming leadership skills gap that had been caused in the housing sector for a variety of reasons, one of which being the change in the structure of the sector. And we've had big changes recently because of COVID-19, but rather like when you ask the question, when is the best time to plant a tree? And the answer was 10 or 25 years ago. You cannot suddenly develop leadership capability. It has to be nurtured and encouraged and looked after. So if a knee-jerk response to the current crisis is to let go of people and to cut back on training and development programs, that's giving you a big problem up the line. So what you want to do is keep people, keep developing them. Maybe there aren't the promotion opportunities, maybe there aren't the pay rises, but we do know, don't we, Rod, that people really welcome development and they like flexible working. So there are many things that have emerged from this pandemic that have reminded us what's important to people. We don't want skills gaps to develop. We don't want to wish that we'd planted the trees 5 years ago. We want to get our people ready. And as Peter Drucker kept reminding us all those years ago, one of the only ways to safeguard your existence in the future is to keep on learning.
Thank you very much, Kate. Well, our next story asks what the Rio Tinto leadership strife tells us about CSR. Mining giant Rio Tinto announced recently that its CEO and two other senior executives will leave the firm following fierce criticism over its destruction of a 46,000-year-old sacred Aboriginal site in Western Australia. In May, the company blew up a series of cave dwellings at Yukon Gorge in the Pilbara region, shelters that comprise one of the earliest known Aboriginal settlements, which had been more or less continuously occupied. In a statement, the Australasian Centre for Corporate Responsibility legal counsel James Fitzgerald said, there are in fact two disasters. The first involves the tragic destruction of Yukon Gorge in May. The second is the dishonest malaise of Rio Tinto's board and senior management in the months since. The first cannot be undone. The damage is irreparable. He noted, investors have stepped up in this instance and demonstrated that they will not accept corporate misinformation and the absolute disrespect to cultural sites that has become Rio's modus operandi. Kate, what should senior leaders in other heavy industry firms take away from the leadership implosion that has occurred at the top of Rio Tinto?
I think what's interesting about this, and I might be wrong, but my understanding is that Rio Tinto actually got its name because it made rivers run red because of its mining activities. Now, that to me was a very socially irresponsible act, but in those days, totally acceptable. I think the message that we're getting here is that actually, at last, shareholders are saying it's not all about profit. There are many other considerations, that gentler, kinder stakeholder capitalism that we've been talking about for a while. And it's only when you get the moral and the business cases sort of advancing together that you get real change. And this does seem to be a high penalty, but what better response can there be to what is absolutely devastating and, as you say, irreparable activity on the part of Rio Tinto to say this is not acceptable, it is not going to happen again in the future. So yeah, you're right, Rod, this is sending a warning to everybody. And I think the days of not having to answer, at least for socially irresponsible behaviour, have passed.
Well, thank you very much, Kate. And our next story links very closely to this. And it's a story taken from Conversation that reminds us that it has now been 50 years since economist Milton Friedman asked and answered a fundamental question. What is the role of business in society? As you, Kate, and our listeners know, Friedman's stance was plain. There is one and only one social responsibility of business: to use its resources and engage in activities designed to increase its profits. That view has long influenced management thinking, corporate governance, and strategy. But more recently, many leaders have sought to expand that definition to consider all the stakeholders who stand to gain or lose from organizations' decisions. For example, in 2019, Business Roundtable released a new statement on the purpose of a corporation, signed by 181 CEOs who committed to lead their companies for the benefit of all stakeholders, customers, employees, suppliers, communities, and shareholders. The statement outlined a modern standard for corporate responsibility. Kate, why is Friedman's stance still so pervasive, even after 50 years?
We still measure in financial terms, and we also look so closely at return on investment and return on shareholder funds. So it's not surprising that we keep pursuing that metric. But we've arrived at a point where we know that if individual optimization of utils, if you can remember that old term from economics, does not actually lead to the best for the whole of society. And I think, as the Rio Tinto story earlier told us, there's a recognition that that isn't the way to go. And I think when Friedman's ideas were really at their height, I can remember, and his pushing of the free market, I can remember an economist from Cranfield saying, well, if the market sets its standard, we wouldn't even need to have pilot exams, because an unsuccessful pilot would have aeroplane crashes and therefore be taken out of the market. Does anybody really want a situation like that? So it was never really accepted in its extreme and pure form. And I think it's being challenged continually. But as I said, as long as return on equity is such an important measure, it is still going to drive behaviour.
Thank you, Kate. Well, our final story is taken from Retail Reimagined, the new era for customer experience, a new international survey by McKinsey. The survey states that in a matter of 90 days, we have vaulted forward 10 years in the United States e-commerce penetration. And in this time, consumers have reset their expectations and preferences and forced retailers to change their trajectory, priorities, and operating model. In a moment of great uncertainty, rather than sticking to familiarity and brands they had used, consumers did the opposite. One of the biggest drivers for abandoning loyalty during the shutdown was items being out of stock. But shoppers were also drawn to brands or retailers that supported their employees during the pandemic, such as by increasing their wages, giving extra sick leave, or paying employees for lost wages. In Germany and the United States, consumers also switched to brands and retailers that repurpose their facilities to help slow the spread of virus, as well as those that led socially responsible COVID-19 initiatives. Kate, does this once again demonstrate the importance of purpose for driving future growth?
I think it does, and I totally agree that we have so fast-forwarded in our digital capability that it's going to absolutely change as we're seeing consumer behaviour. And we commented frequently early on in lockdown here in the UK on that reputation that employers were creating for themselves. Were they, you know, good guys or bad guys? And the good guys have got consumers following them. And that is says something about purpose and about how employer brand is so important, not only in terms of recruitment, but obviously in terms of buying behavior. And one of the great things about the online buying, if you like, is how much further afield you can go to get what you want. And what hasn't been mentioned here, but has been significant, of course, is Black Lives Matter and the encouragement to buy from Black businesses. And I think that's happened more quickly than one would have anticipated, because people have got so much more used to shopping online. So it is a great opportunity for so many retailers to say, do you know, we look after our staff, we look after our customers, we are driven by purpose, not profit, which again is another counter story, if you like, to the Friedman position that we were discussing earlier.
Well, thank you very much, Kate, and that's a very positive note to conclude this week's episode. Listeners can find further topical content in the news and views section on the Institute's website at www.institutelm.com. And thank you once again, Kate, for your insights on these stories.
Thank you, Rod. And of course, thank you to everybody who listens to these podcasts and makes them so enjoyable for us to do them.